He wouldn't stoop to thinking. He just felt it. All he has to do is feel. He feels, the flabby, loose-mouthed, shifty-eyed, drooling, shivering, uncongealed bastard. I, who know what discipline, what effort, what tension of mind, what unrelenting strain upon one's power of clarity are needed to produce a work of art, I who know that it requires a labor which makes a chain gang look like rest, and a severity no army-drilling sadist could impose. I'll take the operator of a coal mine over any walking vehicle of higher mysteries. The operator knows that it's not his feelings that keep the coal carts moving under the earth, and he knows what does keep them moving. Feelings? Oh, yes, we do feel. He, you, and I. We are, in fact, the only people capable of feeling. And we know where our feelings come from. But what we did not know, and have delayed learning for too long, is the nature of those who claim that they cannot account for their feelings. We did not know what it is that they feel. We are learning it now. It was a costly error, and those most guilty of it will pay the hardest price, as in justice they must. Those most guilty of it were the real artists, who will now see that they are first to be exterminated, and that they had prepared the triumph of their own exterminators by helping to destroy their only protectors. For if there is more tragic a fool than the businessman who doesn't know that he's an exponent of man's highest creative spirit, it's the artist who thinks that the businessman is his enemy. It was true, she thought, when she walked through the streets of the valley, looking with a child's excitement at the shop windows sparkling in the sun, that the businesses here had the purposeful selectiveness of art, and that the art, she thought, when she sat in the darkness of a clabbered concert hall listening to the controlled violence and the mathematical precision of Halley's music, had the stern discipline of business. Both had the radiance of engineering, she thought, when she sat among rows of benches under the open sky, watching Kay Ludlow on the stage. It was an experience she had not known since childhood, the experience of being held for 3 hours by a play that told a story she had not seen before, in lines she had not heard, uttering a theme that had not been picked from the hand-me-downs of the centuries. It was the forgotten delight of being held in rapt attention by the reins of the ingenious, the unexpected, the logical, the purposeful, the new, and of seeing it embodied in a performance of superlative artistry by a woman playing a character whose beauty of spirit matched her own physical perfection. "That's why I'm here, Miss Taggart," said Kay Ludlow, smiling in answer to her comment after the performance. "Whatever quality of human greatness I have the talent to portray, that was the quality the outer world sought to degrade. They let me play nothing but symbols of depravity, nothing but harlots, dissipation chasers, and homewreckers, always to be beaten at the end by the little girl next door, personifying the virtue of mediocrity. They used my talent for the defamation of itself. That was why I quit." Not since childhood, thought Dagny, had she felt that sense of exhilaration after witnessing the performance of a play, the sense that life held things worth reaching, not the sense of having studied some aspect of a sewer there had been no reason to see. As the audience filed away into the darkness from the lighted rows of benches, she noticed Ellis Wyatt, Judge Narragansett, Ken Daniger, men who had once been said to despise all forms of art. The last image she caught that evening was the sight of two tall, straight, slender figures walking away together down a trail among the rocks, with the beam of a spotlight flashing once on the gold of their hair. They were Kay Ludlow and Ragnar Danishult. And she wondered whether she could bear to return to a world where these were the two doomed to destruction. The recaptured sense of her own childhood kept coming back to her whenever she met the two sons of the young woman who owned the bakery shop. She often saw them wandering down the trails of the valley, two fearless beings, aged 7 and 4. They seemed to face life as she had faced it. They did not have the look she had seen in the children of the outer world, a look of fear, half secretive, half sneering, the look of a child's defense against an adult, the look of a being in the process of discovering that he is hearing lies, and of learning to feel hatred. The two boys had the open, joyous, friendly confidence of kittens who do not expect to get hurt. They had an innocently natural, non-boastful sense of their own value, and as innocent a trust in any stranger's ability to recognize it. They had the eager curiosity that would venture anywhere with the certainty that life held nothing unworthy of or closed to discovery. and they looked as if, should they encounter malevolence, they would reject it contemptuously, not as dangerous, but as stupid. They would not accept it in bruised resignation as the law of existence. They represent my particular career, Miss Taggart, said the young mother in answer to her comment, wrapping a loaf of fresh bread and smiling at her across the counter. They're the profession I've chosen to practice, which in spite of all the guff about motherhood, one can't practice successfully in the outer world. I believe you've met my husband. He's the teacher of economics who works as linesman for Dick McNamara. You know, of course, that there can be no collective commitments in this valley, and that families or relatives are not allowed to come here unless each person takes the striker's oath by his own independent conviction. I came here not merely for the sake of my husband's profession, but for the sake of my own. I came here in order to bring up my sons as human beings. I would not surrender them to the educational systems devised to stunt a child's brain, to convince him that reason is impotent, that existence is an irrational chaos with which he's unable to deal, and thus reduce him to a state of chronic terror. You marvel at the difference between my children and those outside, Miss Taggart. Yet the cause is so simple. The cause is that here in Galt's Gulch there's no person who would not consider it monstrous ever to confront a child with the slightest suggestion of the irrational. She thought of the teachers whom the schools of the world had lost, when she looked at the three pupils of Dr. Axton on the evening of their yearly reunion. The only other guest he had invited was Kay Ludlow. The six of them sat in the backyard of his house, with the light of the sunset on their faces and the floor of the valley condensing into a soft blue vapor far below. She looked at his pupils, at the three pliant, agile figures half-stretched on canvas chairs in poses of relaxed contentment, dressed in slacks, windbreakers, and open-collared shirts. John Galt, Francisco D'Anconia, Ranyar Danashult. Don't be astonished, Miss Taggart, said Dr. Axton, smiling, and don't make the mistake of thinking that these three pupils of mine are some sort of superhuman creatures. They're something much greater and more astounding than that. They're normal men, a thing the world has never seen, and their feat is that they've managed to survive as such. It does take an exceptional mind and a still more exceptional integrity to remain untouched by the brain-destroying influences of the world's doctrines, the accumulated evil of centuries. To remain human, since the human is the rational. She felt some new quality in Dr. Axton's attitude, some change in the sternness of his usual reserve. He seemed to include her in their circle, as if she were more than a guest. Francisco acted as if her presence at their reunion were natural, and to be taken gaily for granted. Galt's face gave no hint of any reaction. His manner was that of a courteous escort who had brought her here at Dr. Axton's request. She noticed that Dr. Axton's eyes kept coming back to her, as if with the quiet pride of displaying his students to an appreciative observer. His conversation kept returning to a single theme, in the manner of a father who has found a listener interested in his most cherished subject. You should have seen them when they were in college, Miss Taggart. You couldn't have found three boys conditioned to such different backgrounds. But conditioners be damned! They must have picked one another at first sight among the thousands on that campus. Francisco, the richest heir in the world. Ranyar, the European aristocrat. And John, the self-made man. Self-made in every sense, out of nowhere, penniless, parentless, tieless. Actually, he was the son of a gas station mechanic at some forsaken crossroads in Ohio, and he had left home at the age of 12 to make his own way. But I've always thought of him as if he had come into the world like Minerva, the goddess of wisdom, who sprang forth from Jupiter's head fully grown and fully armed. I remember the day when I saw the three of them for the first time. They were sitting at the back of the classroom. I was giving a special course for postgraduate students, so difficult a course that few outsiders ever ventured to attend these particular lectures. Those three looked too young even for freshmen. They were 16 at the time, as I learned later. At the end of that lecture, John got up to ask me a question. It was a question which, as a teacher, I would have been proud to hear from a student who'd taken 6 years of philosophy. It was a question pertaining to Plato's metaphysics, which Plato hadn't had the sense to ask of himself. I answered, and I asked John to come to my office after the lecture. He came. All three of them came. I saw the two others in my anteroom and let them in. I talked to them for an hour. Then I canceled all my appointments and talked to them for the rest of the day, after which I arranged to let them take that course and receive their credits for it. They took the course, they got the highest grades in the class. They were majoring in two subjects, physics and philosophy. Their choice amazed everybody but me. Modern thinkers considered it unnecessary to perceive reality, and modern physicists considered it unnecessary to think. I knew better. What amazed me was that these children knew it, too. Robert Stadler was head of the Department of Physics, as I was head of the Department of Philosophy. He and I suspended all rules and restrictions for these three students. We spared them all the routine, unessential courses. We loaded them with nothing but the hardest tasks, and we cleared their way to major in our two subjects within their 4 years. They worked for it, and during those 4 years they worked for their living besides. Francisco and Ragnar were receiving allowances from their parents. John had nothing, but all three of them held part-time jobs to earn their own experience and money. Francisco worked in a copper foundry. John worked in a railroad roundhouse. And Ragnar... No, Miss Taggart. Ragnar was not the least, but the most studiously sedate of the three. He worked as clerk in the university library. They had time for everything they wanted, but no time for people or for any communal campus activities. They... Ragnar, he interrupted himself suddenly, sharply. Don't sit on the ground. Donnershall had slipped down and was now sitting on the grass with his head leaning against Kay Ludlow's knees. He rose obediently, chuckling. Dr. Axton smiled with a touch of apology. It's an old habit of mine, he explained to Dagny. A conditioned reflex, I guess. I used to tell him that in those college years when I'd catch him sitting on the ground in my backyard on cold, foggy evenings. He was reckless that way. He made me worry. He should have known it was dangerous, and... He stopped abruptly. He read in Dagny's startled eyes the same thought as his own, the thought of the kind of dangers the adult Ragnar had chosen to face. Dr. Axton shrugged, spreading his hands in a gesture of helpless self-mockery. Kay Ludlow smiled at him in understanding. My house stood just outside the campus, he continued, sighing, on a tall bluff over Lake Erie. We spent many evenings together, the four of us. We would sit just like this in my backyard on the nights of early fall or in the spring. Only instead of this granite mountainside, we had the spread of the lake before us, stretching off into a peacefully unlimited distance. I had to work harder on those nights than in any classroom, answering all the questions they'd ask me, discussing the kind of issues they'd raise. About midnight, I would fix some hot chocolate and force them to drink it. The one thing I suspected was that they never took time to eat properly. And then we'd go on talking while the lake vanished into solid darkness and the sky seemed lighter than the earth. There were a few times when we stayed there till I noticed suddenly that the sky was turning darker and the lake was growing pale and we were within a few sentences of daylight. I should have known better. I knew that they weren't getting enough sleep as it was, but I forgot it occasionally. I lost my sense of time. You see, when they were there, I always felt as if it were early morning and a long, inexhaustible day were stretching ahead before us. They never spoke of what they wished they might do in the future. They never wondered whether some mysterious omnipotence had favored them with some unknowable talent to achieve the things they wanted. They spoke of what they would do. Does affection tend to make one a coward? I know that the only times I felt fear were occasional moments when I listened to them and thought of what the world was becoming and what they would have to encounter in the future. Fear? Yes, but it was more than fear. It was the kind of emotion that makes men capable of killing. When I thought that the purpose of the world's trend was to destroy these children, that these three sons of mine were marked for immolation. Oh, yes, I would have killed. But whom was there to kill? It was everyone, and no one. There was no single enemy, no center, and no villain. It was not the simpering social worker incapable of earning a penny, or the thieving bureaucrat scared of his own shadow. It was the whole of the earth rolling into an obscenity of horror, pushed by the hand of every would-be decent man who believed that need is holier than ability and pity is holier than justice. But these were only occasional moments. It was not my constant feeling. I listened to my children, and I knew that nothing would defeat them. I looked at them as they sat in my backyard, and beyond my house, there were the tall, dark buildings of what was still a monument to unenslaved thought, the Patrick Henry University. And farther in the distance, there were the lights of Cleveland, the orange glow of steel mills behind batteries of smokestacks, the twinkling red dots of radio towers, the long white rays of airports on the black edge of the sky. And I thought that in the name of any greatness that had ever existed and moved this world, the greatness of which they were the last descendants. They would win. I remember one night when I noticed that John had been silent for a long time, and I saw that he had fallen asleep stretched there on the ground. The two others confessed that he had not slept for 3 days. I sent the two of them home at once, but I didn't have the heart to disturb him. It was a warm spring night. I brought a blanket to cover him, and I let him sleep where he was. I sat there beside him till morning, and as I watched his face in the starlight, then the first ray of the sun on his untroubled forehead and closed eyelids, what I experienced was not a prayer. I do not pray, but that state of spirit at which a prayer is a misguided attempt, a full, confident, affirming self-dedication to my love of the right, to the certainty that the right would win, and that this boy would have the kind of future he deserved. He moved his arm, pointing to the valley. I did not expect it to be as great as this, or as hard. It had grown dark, and the mountains had blended with the sky. Hanging detached in space, there were the lights of the valley below them, the red breath of Stockton's foundry above, and the lighted string of windows of Mulligan's house, like a railroad car embedded in the sky. "I did have a rival," said Dr. Axton slowly. "It was Robert Stadler. Don't frown, John, it's past. John did love him once. Well, so did I. No, not quite. But what one felt for a mind like Stadler's was painfully close to love. It was that rarest of pleasures, admiration. No, I did not love him. But he and I had always felt as if we were fellow survivors from some vanishing age or land in the gibbering swamp of mediocrity around us. The mortal sin of Robert Stadler was that he never identified his proper homeland. He hated stupidity. It was the only emotion I'd ever seen him display toward people. A biting, bitter, weary hatred for any ineptitude that dared to oppose him. He wanted his own way. He wanted to be left alone to pursue it. He wanted to brush people out of his path. And he never identified the means to it, or the nature of his path and of his enemies. He took a short cut. Are you smiling, Miss Taggart? You hate him, don't you? Yes, you know the kind of short cut he took. He told you that we were rivals for these three students. That was true. Or rather, that was not the way I thought of it, but I knew that he did. Well, if we were rivals, I had one advantage. I knew why they needed both our professions. He never understood their interest in mine. He never understood its importance to himself, which incidentally is what destroyed him. But in those years, he was still alive enough to grasp at these three students. Grasp was the word for it. Intelligence being the only value he worshipped, he clutched them as if they were a private treasure of his own. He had always been a very lonely man. I think that in the whole of his life, Francisco and Ranyar were his only love, and John was his only passion. It was John whom he regarded as his particular heir, as his future, as his own immortality. John intended to be an inventor, which meant that he was to be a physicist. He was to take his postgraduate course under Robert Stadler. Francisco intended to leave after graduation and go to work. He was to be the perfect blend of both of us, his two intellectual fathers, an industrialist, and Ranyar. You didn't know what profession Ranyar had chosen, Miss Taggart? No, it wasn't stunt pilot or jungle explorer or deep-sea diver. It was something much more courageous than these. Ranyar intended to be a philosopher, an abstract, theoretical, academic, cloistered, ivory tower philosopher. Yes, Robert Stadler loved them. And yet, I have said that I would have killed to protect them. Only there was no one to kill, if that were the solution, which of course it isn't. The man to kill was Robert Stadler. Of any one person, of any single guilt for the evil which is now destroying the world, his was the heaviest guilt. He had the mind to know better. His was the only name of honor and achievement used to sanction the rule of the looters. He was the man who delivered science into the power of the looters' guns. John did not expect it, neither did I. John came back for his postgraduate course in physics, but he did not finish it. He left on the day when Robert Stadler endorsed the establishment of a state science institute. I met Stadler by chance in a corridor of the university as he came out of his office after his last conversation with John. He looked changed. I hope that I shall never have to see a change of that kind in a man's face. He saw me approaching, and he did not know, but I knew what made him whirl upon me and cry, "I'm so sick of all of you impractical idealists." I turned away. I knew that I'd heard a man pronounce a death sentence upon himself. "Miss Taggart, do you remember the question you asked me about my three pupils?" "Yes," she whispered. "I could gather from your question the nature of what Robert Stadler had said to you about them. Tell me, why did he speak of them at all?" He saw the faint movement of her bitter smile. "He told me their story as a justification for his belief in the futility of human intelligence. He told it to me as an example of his disillusioned hope. Theirs was the kind of ability, he said, one expects to see in the future changing the course of the world." "Well, haven't they done so?" She nodded slowly, holding her head inclined for a long moment in acquiescence and in homage. "What I want you to understand, Miss Taggart, is the full evil of those who claim to have been convinced that this earth, by its nature, is a realm of malevolence where the good has no chance to win. Let them check their premises. Let them check their standards of value. Let them check, before they grant themselves the unspeakable license of evil as necessity, whether they know what is the good and what are the conditions it requires. Robert Stadler now believes that intelligence is futile and that human life can be nothing but irrational. Did he expect John Galt to become a great scientist, willing to work under the orders of Dr. Floyd Ferris? Did he expect Francisco D'Anconia to become a great industrialist, willing to produce under the orders and for the benefit of Wesley Mooch? Did he expect Ranyar Daneshul to become a great philosopher, willing to preach under the orders of Dr. Simon Pritchett that there is no mind and that might is right? Would that have been a future which Robert Stadler would have considered rational? I want you to observe, Miss Taggart, that those who cry the loudest about their disillusionment, about the failure of virtue, the futility of reason, the impotence of logic, are those who have achieved the full, exact, logical result of the ideas they preached, so mercilessly logical that they dare not identify it. In a world that proclaims the non-existence of the mind, the moral righteousness of rule by brute force, the penalizing of the competent in favor of the incompetent, the sacrifice of the best to the worst, in such a world, the best have to turn against society and have to become its deadliest enemies. In such a world, John Galt, the man of incalculable intellectual power, will remain an unskilled laborer. Francisco D'Anconia, the miraculous producer of wealth, will become a wastrel, and Ranyar Daneshold, the man of enlightenment, will become the man of violence. Society and Dr. Robert Stadler have achieved everything they advocated. What complaint do they now have to make? That the universe is irrational? Is it? He smiled. His smile had the pitiless gentleness of certainty. Every man builds his world in his own image, he said. He has the power to choose, but no power to escape the necessity of choice. If he abdicates his power, he abdicates the status of man. And the grinding chaos of the irrational is what he achieves as his sphere of existence, by his own choice. Whoever preserves a single thought uncorrupted by any concession to the will of others, whoever brings into reality a matchstick or a patch of garden made in the image of his thought, he, and to that extent, is a man, and that extent is the sole measure of his virtue. They, he pointed at his pupils, made no concessions. This, he pointed at the valley, is the measure of what they preserved and of what they are. Now I can repeat my answer to the question you asked me, knowing that you will understand it fully. You asked me whether I was proud of the way my three sons had turned out. I am more proud than I had ever hoped to be. I am proud of their every action, of their every goal, and of every value they've chosen. And this, Dagny, is my full answer. The sudden sound of her first name was pronounced in the tone of a father. He spoke his last two sentences, looking not at her, but at Galt. She saw Galt answering him by an open glance, held steady for an instant, like a signal of affirmation. Then Galt's eyes moved to hers. She saw him looking at her as if she bore the unspoken title that hung in the silence between them, the title Dr. Axton had granted her but had not pronounced, and none of the others had caught. She saw in Galt's eyes a glance of amusement at her shock, of support, and, incredibly, of tenderness. Donconia Copper Number 1 was a small cut on the face of the mountain that looked as if a knife had made a few angular slashes, leaving shelves of rock red as a wound on the reddish-brown flank. The sun beat down upon it. Dagny stood at the edge of a path, holding on to Galt's arm on one side and to Francisco's on the other, the wind blowing against their faces and out over the valley, 2,000 feet below. This, she thought, looking at the mine, was the story of human wealth written across the mountains. A few pine trees hung over the cut, contorted by the storms that had raged through the wilderness for centuries. 6 men worked on the shelves, and an inordinate amount of complex machinery traced delicate lines against the sky. The machinery did most of the work. She noticed that Francisco was displaying his domain to Galt as much as to her, as much or more. "You haven't seen it since last year, John. John, wait till you see it a year from now. I'll be through outside in just a few months, and then this will be my full-time job." "Hell no, John," he said, laughing, in answer to a question. But she caught suddenly the particular quality of his glance whenever it rested on Galt. It was the quality she had seen in his eyes when he had stood in her room, clutching the edge of a table to outlive an unlivable moment. He had looked as if he were seeing someone before him. It was Galt, she thought. It was Galt's image that had carried him through. Some part of her felt a dim dread. The effort which Francisco had made in that moment to accept her loss and his rival as the payment demanded of him for his battle had cost him so much that he was now unable to suspect the truth Dr. Axton had guessed. "What will it do to him when he learns?" she wondered, and felt a bitter voice reminding her that there would perhaps never be any truth of this kind to learn. Some part of her felt a dim tension as she watched the way Galt looked at Francisco. It was an open, simple, unreserved glance of surrender to an unreserved feeling. She felt the anxious wonder she had never fully named or dismissed. Wonder whether this feeling would bring him down to the ugliness of renunciation. But most of her mind seemed swept by some enormous sense of release, as if she were laughing at all doubts. Her glance kept going back over the path they had traveled to get here, over the 2 exhausting miles of a twisted trail that ran like a precarious corkscrew from the tip of her feet down to the floor of the valley. Her eyes kept studying it, her mind racing with some purpose of its own. Brush, pines, and a clinging carpet of moss went climbing from the green slopes far below up the granite ledges. The moss and the brush vanished gradually, but the pines went on, struggling upward in thinning strands, till only a few dots of single trees were left, rising up the naked rock toward the white sunbursts of snow in the crevices at the peaks. She looked at the spectacle of the most ingenious mining machinery she had ever seen, then at the trail where the plodding hoofs and swaying shapes of mules provided the most ancient form of transportation. "Francisco?" she asked, pointing. "Who designed the machines?" "They're just adaptations of standard equipment." "Who designed them?" "I did. We don't have many men to spare. We had to make up for it." "You're wasting an unconscionable amount of manpower and time carting your ore on muleback. You ought to build a railroad down to the valley." She was looking down, and did not notice the sudden eager shot of his glance to her face, or the sound of caution in his voice. "I know it. But it's such a difficult job that the mine's output won't justify it at present." "Nonsense. It's much simpler than it looks. There's a pass to the east where there's an easier grade and softer stone. I watched it on the way up. It wouldn't take so many curves. 3 miles of rail or less would do it." She was pointing east. She did not notice the intensity with which the 2 men were watching her face. "Just a narrow-gauge track is all you'll need, like the first railroads. That's where the first railroad started, at mines, only they were coal mines. Look, do you see that ridge? There's plenty of clearance for a 3-foot gauge. You wouldn't need to do any blasting or widening. Do you see where there's a slow rise for a stretch of almost 0.5 mile? That would be no worse than a 4% grade. Any engine could manage it."